job down at the local mill. Worked right up, not a minute till I can pay my bills. Revo man is at my door. You could call us working class, but we're just not working anymore. Well, I had me a wife, get a car and a boat. Things got bad now, the boat won't float. I don't like it. I'm too proud to be poor. They used to call us working class, but we're just not working anymore. We're not a working. We're not a working. We're just not working anymore. They used to call us working class.
Hello, folks. And welcome to the December 12th, 2015 edition of the World Labor Hour, brought to you over the airwaves at WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM and streaming worldwide at weft.org. Got a full house here today, except for the primary host of the show, David Johnson. He'll be back next week. So anyway, here's Gus with some of the underwriters.
This hour of programming is brought to you in part by Central Illinois Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Central Illinois Jobs with Justice holds regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month at 9:30 a.m. at Channing Murray Foundation, 1209 West Oregon, Urbana. For more information, visit www.centralillinoisjobswithjustice.org. Programming on the World Labor Hour is supported in part by listeners of WEFT and Decatur attorney Bill Faber, who believes that the mission of the law is the safety of the people. Bill Faber proudly supports the World Labor Hour. The World Labor Hour is supported in part by listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois. The Graduate Employees Organization Union, GEO, at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign strives to not only democratically represent graduate employees, but also to give solidarity and support to other unions, organizations, and workers engaged in the struggle for social justice, both on and off campus. The GEO is proud to support the World Labor Hour on WEFT Community Radio.
Excellent. Thanks, Gus. And want to mention that the views and opinions expressed here are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT, its board of directors, associates, station manager, or a Prairie Air Incorporated.
Or the triumvirate.
Or the triumvirate, yes. So, Gus, you got a news story you want to kind of kick it off with here this week?
Or? Yeah, been a very busy week, both nationally and locally. There's been a lot of tension and a lot of problems coming out of the Champaign Police Department right now. There is currently a police officer that is causing the city to settle multiple police brutality settlement cases, use of force lawsuits, they like to call them. City officials are negotiating to settle two more lawsuits after one previous one claiming excessive use of force by police officer Matt Rush. Three internal investigations into that officer's conduct led the police chief to fire him, a decision that was overturned by an arbitrator hired by the FOP. So the FOP basically got an officer with a pattern and history of violence to walk the streets again.
Rehired,
yeah.
Wow.
The officer, Matt Rush, was the subject of a lawsuit on December 1st by the city council. The pending suits could cost the city significantly more than $25,000 settlement in that case. In response to media inquiries, the Champaign Police Department Thursday morning released documents spelling out internal investigations, citizens' complaints, videos which are critical to what's happening with Matt Rush, and pending litigation regarding an officer accused in three lawsuits of using excessive force. So the documents number in the hundreds and include multiple investigations and complaints and letters of discipline against Rush. So we have multiple now. He's only been accused formally of three excessive use of forces, but But judging from what they released on Thursday, there are hundreds of documents wow. where citizens and other people within the police department are complaining about this guy. And the FOP, who we all know is central to stopping police brutality cases from people trying and getting these nasty cops off the street, they just put another cop back on the street who has a pattern of hurting citizens. Yeah. I mean, this is bizarre. It's bizarre from a citizen standpoint, but this is how repression in state and police states work. You have to keep people on the street who engage in that type of behavior, who can repress the democratic public.
So they went against the chief of police on one of these issues, the FOP, correct? The chief of police essentially fire Matt Rush?
Or yeah, they fired him. I mean, he was gone. Yeah. And the FOP hired this arbitrator to fight for overtime to get him back on.
Yeah.
And now he has his regular beat again. He's back on the streets. And we're talking about, this is not just a spurt. One of his incidents happened a few years ago.
Right.
And some of them happened this year. So like I said, he has a pattern of violence over a long period of time.
Right.
And he's still on the street.
Yeah.
And so,
there's three videos available, right?
Yeah. All the videos were released of his incidents, the dash cam camera. And you can see some of them are incredibly nasty. There are pictures that were released as well with the victims' faces, like literally just beaten down and bloody. Like they released all that stuff, and yet he's still on the street. So you can best believe that that the community is going to come out for this, because this is unprecedented. Nobody expected this guy to be back on the street and able to police people, knowing that he has this pattern of violence. So the people are going to come out for this.
One of the lawsuits was settled for $25,000, mm-hmm. and one is being discussed at a level of like $225,000, mm-hmm. costing the city quite a bit of money to keep this man employed there.
You know, like I said, the FOP protects their own, though. You know, that's a very big thing. Police culture here is not about individuality and one bad cop versus another good cop. It's about a brotherhood. The FOP is put out to, they're historically, and we have to start really scrutinizing and critically engaging the FOP as actually being a police, an actual union. Because from my historical understanding, unions are help working conditions and to help the actual support of the labor of these people. That's not what the FOP does. The FOP covers up and protects. That's all they do. Yeah. They give out this falsehood of unionization and wanting to help their officers be better people and give them better conditions. And well, you know, they just made a mistake, but they were engaging in a dangerous situation. Their life was on the line.
And yeah.
Like I said, you know, there's tons of histories that have been written about the FOP literally ignoring that stuff and engaging in tactics that involve white supremacy and upholding capitalism. I mean, there's no surprise that the FOP represents a large number of officers that are in poor, impoverished areas. I mean, that's not a coincidence.
Right.
There's a reasoning behind what they do, and they're a very dangerous organization. So, yeah.
Yeah. Bill, you got a story over there you wanna?
No.
Okay. I got a story here that came out this week from the Pew Research Group. It says the American middle class is losing ground. It says after more than four decades of serving as the nation's economic majority, the American middle class is now matched in number by those in the economic tiers above it and below it. In early 2015, 120.8 million adults were in middle income households, compared with 121.3 million in lower and upper income households combined. It's a demographic shift that could signal a tipping point, according to the new Pew Research Center analysis of government data. It says over the same period, the nation's aggregate household income has substantially shifted from middle income to upper income households, driven by the growing size of the upper income tier and more rapid gains in income at the top. Fully 49% of U.S. aggregate income went to upper income households in 2014. That's up from only 29% in 1970. So quite a big jump there from 29% to 49% in about 40 years, you know. Mm-hmm. The share accruing to middle income households was 43% in 2014. That was down substantially from 62% in 1970. So, a major shift in, our economy going towards the upper tier there. And here's a little article from a gentleman, George Hudspeth. He's a former business manager of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 323, down in Palm Beach, Florida. And he says he's seen these articles in the Palm Beach Post about the destruction of the American middle class. The decline can be seen with the decline of Americans' labor unions. With a weakened labor movement, American workers have no representation. And he attributed it to four factors. The destruction of America's employees' standard of living can be contributed to four policies over the last 30 years. Trickle-down tax relief for the wealthiest Americans, the China Trade Relations Act, CTRA, North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA. Number three was a defined contribution plans, 401ks instead of defined benefit plans, where the company handles the retirement. And number four, the independent contractor 1099 form. So that's what he attributes much of the loss of unions' power to, these four factors. And we've talked, you know, previously many times about the TPP and how that's going to continue to just erode the power of unions and workers here.
Yeah, I did notice something you mentioned there too is the 1099 independent contractors. Actually, I was talking to somebody one day who is a Federal Express driver. Yeah. And Federal Express has, even though you're driving a big truck that says Federal Express on it, and you're wearing this really, sometimes, oh, this guy had their summer uniform on, really dorky. I mean, I felt sorry for him. And all that, and they're telling you where to go, and you go to their place, and you pick all the stuff up, you know. But anyway, something that's been happening, I believe, is that, and this is because of the campaign by the Teamsters on this topic, where there are some of these people who are buying multiple trucks and then hiring drivers for the trucks.
Wow.
And I don't know, I'm not sure if somehow maybe Federal Express is, how they're encouraging this to happen. Okay. And because I was surprised at that too, because there was actually a Facebook friend who's a anarchist who gotten a job with one of these
FedEx.
FedEx subcontractors.
Yeah.
You know. So basically I think what happens, of course your gross income doesn't go down because but instead of you having every quarter, see, I know how this works. My dad tried this for a few years with the trucks that he owned years ago. This was like 30 years ago, then they finally, he couldn't do it. And that is because if you're doing this, and Bob, as you probably well know, as you're an independent contractor yourself, you have to do your quarterly taxes.
Yep.
Get them paid up. You gotta write that, was it 12.4%?
Yep.
Checks on your
self-employment tax at the end of the year.
Yep. For your Social Security and all that.
Yep.
And that's a pain in the butt.
Yep.
Besides, you know, you really see where that goes.
Right.
Insurance.
Right.
You know, now you have to deal with that.
Yep.
Yeah. I mean, really, one of the funniest things that you hear often from the political candidates, the electoral officials, is this idea that the middle class is going away and that it's shrinking, which is true, but their overemphasis on a middle class that has always been predominantly small in the first place is incredible, because we can see, and one of the things you can, a lot of political theorists are already talking about this, this idea that the working class is swelling. Well, the working class started swelling going back past the Emancipation Proclamation, you know, the ending of the Civil War.
Yeah, the Industrial Revolution and things like that.
Exactly. Yeah. The creation of the industrial working class,
you know, under feudalism.
Exactly.
And actually, if you look at the United States, there was, you know, a lot of things except for indentured servants and slaves. You didn't really have a lot of quite employment.
Exactly.
Right. You know, and then the first mills started happening. And you're right, man. There's so much confusion in the United States about class, and I think that's one of the really major cultural problems that we have that keeps us down.
Yep.
Right.
And there's a lot of ways to look at it. For example, there's a big difference between, you know, we have working class, okay, people who are not management, people who do the actual work. Mm-hmm. However, you do have blue collar work is different.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
You see?
Yep.
And, one of my favorite definitions is, well, the blue collar work's where you take a shower after work. You know, where, if you're white collar, you know that. You take your shower before work. Yeah. Number two, as a blue collar worker, you have very little control over your time.
There it is.
For example, and this came up between me and the founder of this program, Peter Miller, back when it was just me and him doing this. And see, Peter was, had the ability first as a graduate student and then as a staffer organizer for the, IEA. He had, was doing basically white collar work all the time, which is, well, I could go ahead and do this later and I'll call somebody and do the recorded interview, right here in the middle of the afternoon. And at one time we were discussing these things and he goes, well, you don't value my work as much. And I said, no, it's not that. It's just that I can't schedule my time. I have to pour my piece of concrete with everybody else on the crew.
Yep.
You know, that is a big, big difference. Yeah. And that is something that I see as being a real barrier to true working class participation in, various political activities, especially with all the distractions we have now. Just the thing, it's like, well, I can't go to that meeting or rally or something because, not only do I have to be in this work 40 hours a week at this particular place, but, there's a soccer game, a lot of these things.
Yeah. I mean, I agree 100%. I think that's the one barrier to working class. And this is something that has always been exacerbated by the capitalists and the petty bourgeoisie is this idea that, if I divide the working classes into all these little subgroups, they're going to start conflicting with one another. And by doing that and by pushing this idea of a middle class, which has always been the smallest group in the country and not focusing on the working class, then people are going to start engaging in all types of identity politics that really break apart this idea of class, because that's what that's what they use. They said, because you're white, you're better than this black person. Mm-hmm. That stuff has not gone away in terms, and not strictly by race. Now you have interracial conflict within the black working class and the white working class that say, because you're not this identity, then you need to be, your struggle is not, as admirable as somebody else's. And this is what the media is like just pumping out and helping a lot of these petty bourgeoisie liberals go about saying. Like, they're in other words, they're taking
petty bourgeoisie. That's how I like that.
Yeah, that's what it is.
That's
That's what it is. The petty bourgeoisie, for those that don't understand, that's the group that wishes to be a part of the capitalist class, and they take on their ideals knowing that they themselves are just as oppressed as other groups. And they're trying to remove the class argument from the idea of struggle, which is insane. That's the reason why we can't ever have a working class coalition, is because they are removing class from the ideas and the theory of struggle.
Yeah,
you have to bring it back.
And look how much of your petty bourgeoisie is made up of, say, artisans, small business people, professionals, people who are quite often very active in things,
and academics,
yeah.
They've been cowardly from day one, and and just be honest, they have the ability to actually make change with producing literature and scholarly work that can transcend different classes, and people can actually read these things. But they've been actually co-opted and working with the bourgeoisie and capitalist class in producing narratives that remove class structure and continue to divide working people. I mean, that's what they do. And I call academics out all the time. Like, this anti-intellectual, pseudo-intellectual garbage is killing the struggle right now.
Well, talk about cultural production. Here's something I accidentally happened across this morning. And, actually what I was first watching is the video where, it's a child, an anarchist kid, like, lectures Charlie Chaplin. But it's from this movie that I'd never heard of before. It was actually Charlie Chaplin's last starring role in 1957, and it was called A King in New York. And it always amazes me how when I go back and I look at different eras of American film and television, compared to today, the 1950s just had this really interesting thing going on with a lot of politics and stuff, but it had to be hidden.
Yeah.
I mean, for example, the pajama game. Doris Day, you know, is a union organizer in the pajama factory, and her love interest is a guy who runs the factory, you know, and all the thing goes along with that. But these things were kind of snuck in these musicals.
Yeah.
Or, of course, one of my absolute favorite in this regard, Never Steal Anything Small. Which was, you know, about, James Cagney, a musical comedy about him being the corrupt leader of a longshore workers union local. But then this story here was A King in New York. It's a 1957 British comedy directed and starring Charlie Chaplin, who, you know, is very progressive and many ways. And the scene in this movie is he goes to this school, and what it is he was the king of this place called Astoria, a small place in Europe, and he gets kicked out, and he comes to New York, and actually the kid in the scene is his actual son. Which, and when I first saw it, I thought, man, it seems like he's a lot like Charlie Chaplin, but it's just amazing. But the thing is Charlie Chaplin's touring the school, and the kid is their history genius student, and he edits the paper, and he goes into this really huge, long analysis of capitalism and anarchist theory. But of course, this is a British film, but it's set in the United States. But I don't know. And now you just don't.
Yeah, you don't see that stuff anymore.
You got crap, man. Yeah. Reality show.
I mean, you can go back to like I said, the sci-fi era between the 50s and 60s were heavily anti-capitalist critiques. And I go back to that show, The Outer Limits, that came out in 1963. Yeah. You're talking about some of the greatest television
ever. Well, that's
what
Rod Serling said about The Twilight Zone, is that was how he could express his in science
fiction.
Social
commentary.
That stuff was, I mean, we're talking about like almost every episode involves some type of mass organizing of people to fight some type of ruling elite or some type of, it was some type of critique of a surveillance state in a couple of episodes. There was one about the use of nuclear weapons and how it's destroying the working people. I mean, it was an amazing series, and they really need to start reshowing those or releasing them on DVD again, because I think they're out of print now. But I put that up against any of
YouTube. They'll be on YouTube. As a matter of fact, this movie, if you go to the Wikipedia page, A King in New York, you can watch the movie right on the page.
Wow.
But another one I'd like to bring up in real quickly, and that is Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know how many times I have seen all these really smart people who should know better come out constantly, almost every time that film is brought up, it's, oh, it was about the communists, the pods, the communists would turn you into a pod. No! If I read an interview with Don Siegel, in a book that was probably published in 1975, and it was at Milner Library at Illinois State University, and for the life of me, I can't remember the name of the book and find it. I guess I'll have to go back there and see if it's still there. It's a book of interviews with film directors. Don Siegel says right there in this book, no, this was not about communism. It was about the American corporations. Mm-hmm. You know, it was the old gray flannel suit idea from the 1950s. Mm-hmm. And he goes, and I never wanted to call it Invasion of the Body Snatchers either. That was the corporate pods that thought of that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and right there, it's just amazing how people were using various media at the time. Mm-hmm.
Let's take a musical break. We start our show every week.
Yeah, let's get cultural with music.
Yeah. We start our show every week with Pete Anderson, and the song's titled Working Class. And by request, we're going to do an old Leadbelly tune, and this is the Bourgeois Blues here.
Oh, yeah.
This is for our friend Jim.
I think he wrote that in the 1950s.
Yeah.
I mean, he was in Washington, D.C. at the time.
Was he?
Yeah.
I was going to place it back in the 30s or 40s.
I might be wrong.
There you go. But, we're going to listen to Bourgeois Blues from Leadbelly. This is for my friend, requested by our friend Jim. And then we'll be right back with our guest and a couple of public service announcements. And stick around. You're listening to the World
Jim
Labor Hour.
Jim can call in and tell us when it was written.
He probably can. Exactly. Yeah. So, you're listening to the World Labor Hour here on WEFT Champaign. Thank you.
put down. I got the bourgeois blues, gonna spread the news all around. Me and Martin, we were standing upstairs. I heard a white man say, I don't want no niggas up there. Lord, he's a bourgeois man. Bushboy town, I got a bushboy blues gonna spread the news all around. Home of the brave, land of the free. I don't wanna be mistreated by no bourgeoisie, Lord, in a bushboy town. Ooh, it's a bushboy town. I got a bushboy blues gonna. Spreading news all around. The people are turning us down, Lord, in a bourgeois town. It's a bourgeois town. I got the bourgeois blues, I'm gonna spread the news all around. The white folks in Washington, they know how. Took a colored man a nigga just to see him bow, Lord, it's a bourgeois town. It's a bourgeois town. I got the bourgeois blues, I'm gonna spread the news all around. Tell all the colored folks to listen to me. Don't try to find no home in Washington, D.C., cause there's a bourgeois town. It's a bourgeois town. I got the bourgeois blues and I'm still gonna spread the news.
Bourgeois Blues.
Bell Bob?
Leadbelly. Bill's got a little bit about that song.
I was half right. According to Wikipedia, the Bourgeois Blues is a blues song by American folk and blues musician Leadbelly. The song was written in June 1937 in response to discrimination and segregation that Leadbelly faced during a trip to Washington, D.C. to record for Alan Lomax.
Yeah.
So that was right. He was in Washington. What's interesting, too, is this is the B-side of a song called... of a record called Gallus Pole.
Yeah.
G-A-L-L-I-S, which is actually a kind of an ancient British folk song.
Yeah.
Going back, how many hundred years? And, of course, it was recorded also by Led Zeppelin as Gallows Pole.
Yep.
Hangman, ride me many a mile.
Yep. Mm-hmm. A couple of public service announcements for you folks out there. Of course, this evening is the Locked Out Rockout. That's happening at the Plumbers and Pipe Fitters Hall at 1005 North Dunlap in Savoy. It's going to be put on by the East Central Illinois Building Trades from 5 till 11. They got a dinner going on from 5 to 8, and it looks like dinner is provided by Anderson's Catering. And from 8 to 11, they got music from Killer Bee Honey. And beverages provided by J.T. Walker's. That's this evening from 5 to 11. Lockout Rockout, as Paul said, you can find that on Facebook. If you go to Facebook and type in Lockout Rockout, and that's to raise money for the locked out workers at Clifford Jacobs Forging up there. Been going on for, over 2 months now, since the beginning of October, I believe. So, quite a long story there.
I found it with a Google search, and the first thing that popped up was shambanamoms.com.
They're involved with the Lockout Rockout?
Well, apparently they do an event announcements or something. I don't know what this. Never heard shambanamoms.com.
Yeah. Shambana Moms. Yeah, they do some things around town.
The top online resource for Champaign-Urbana area families.
There you go.
There you go. More local media.
Support local families, support local workers, support locked out workers.
So. Support local media like WEFT.
There you go. Yeah, we want to thank our worker that came in here just before the show started today and made a very generous pledge.
He
listens to the Labor Hour all the time, and we appreciate all the workers out there listening to us at WEFT in Champaign, 90.1 FM, and streaming at WEFT.org. I just want to say,
one of the best things that you can do for WEFT right now, besides give money, and actually we are in a pretty dire situation, I'm just going to go ahead and say it, is get other people to listen.
Right.
For example, if you have friends who used to listen to The Whip, point them to WEFT.
We have a lot of the same folk in country, bluegrass, and blues music here that the Whip used to carry.
Remember, too, you can stream WEFT on your phone or your pad or something else. All people can. You can listen to WEFT in your car anywhere in the world right now.
Yep.
You can listen to it at work. You can listen to it in all kinds of places because it is now streaming online. You know, and I mean it. People all over the world.
Yeah.
You know, get all your friends.
We have some sensational world music here on afternoons 2 to 4 every Monday through Friday. Ooh. So, you know, that appeals to people all around the world.
Yeah. Right.
Great blues, great jazz. I mean, more blues and jazz than you'll hear on any other radio station in this area. So.
Except for maybe, you can't get it in Champaign that well. It kind of peters out at 57, and that is 89.1 in Bloomington, which is, Illinois State University's public radio station. And by the way, the blues was started at that station by a retired laborer from Clinton.
Well,
one of the brothers, I believe, was worked out of the Decatur local.
A couple other quick mentions here, you know, Not Another Sports Show comes up at 2
o'clock.
More
local media.
WRFU, our sister station, we sometimes call them, over there in Urbana.
Now, are they streaming yet?
Not streaming yet, but you catch them at 104.5. Neil Parthon, always has a great show.
Awesome show.
Yeah, if you're within about 5 miles of Lincoln Square, tune in.
Yeah. And also Labor's View TV, that's every Sunday, 4 o'clock on Comcast Cable Channel 6. Typical host of this show, David Johnson, hosts that show and brings you some great films and videos dealing with labor.
Yeah.
Why don't we get to our guest here? We got a guest in the studio.
A local guest.
Yeah.
More locality.
Yeah.
More important for terrestrial broadcasters.
Yeah. Nancy Dietrich. And she's going to talk about a book that kind of does what Gus is saying here, is academics putting out some good opinions and good knowledge out there and stuff.
Yeah, finally people, well not finally, but there's always been pockets. Now, let me not homogenize intellectuals now. I'm talking about for the majority of intellectual history, intellectuals have been very soft and passive on the role of capitalism in oppression in the United States and American Empire. But there are a couple, like the people we're going to talk about today, that actually are trying to really tackle why it needs to fall in order to save the world.
This book, Naomi Klein, This Changes Everything, and we're reading it in a AWARE reading group, and David Johnson is a member of that reading group, and so that's I've known David for a long time, but he invited me to come on the show.
So is that a regular, or is it weekly, monthly?
Usually weekly, although it kind of varies depending on what's going on. So, and this was one of the books that we've read so far, so and it's relatively new. The book group is relatively new, so but I did want to add another public announcement that kind of goes along with this book. At noon on campus at the alma mater, they're having a climate rally. So anybody who wants to sound the alarm too that we need to do something about climate change, noon at the alma mater on the corner of Green and Wright on campus.
Mary, you can go there right now and stream us on your phone.
There you
That's right.
So. And then
what day is that rally?
It's right now.
Right now.
I mean, it's today.
Saturday the 12th at noon. It says with the completion of the Paris climate talks, what results will they have brought, and what must we do next to ensure that the earth remains a livable place for our descendants? So it says, come to this rally and find out, happening at noon at the alma mater.
All right, so after the show goes off, please head on over to the alma mater to join that great rally.
This says the local rally was organized by Students for Environmental Concerns and Champaign-Urbana for Bernie Sanders and other groups. So.
All right.
Great. Wonderful. And here we're back to our guest, Nancy Dietrich.
Well, this book, I just, you know, for anybody who hasn't read it, it's a really good wake-up call. It was for me for climate change. And climate change had always been on my radar screen, but this really did a good job of sounding the alarm of how much of it. This is really a climate crisis. I mean, we're really, we've done a lot of talk about it. We were talking about this earlier. Countries have done a lot of talk about it, but not enough action. In fact, the COP21 talks that are going on now, I didn't know what 21 meant, but 21 means that this is the 21st climate summit that we have had since 1992. So we have been talking about climate change for over 20 years and without very much action. I can just keep going on with my comments,
sure.
But one of the things I think that really woke me up when I read this book was her comments about the 2 degrees Celsius target. And it's a pretty well-known target that is supposedly, quote unquote, the safe target for if we keep emissions from growing, so we keep the degrees below 2 degrees Celsius, we should be able to adapt. And what she says in the book, that target has more to do with minimizing economic disruption than it really does from minimizing destruction from climate change. Mm. And she also mentions that the World Bank of all organizations came out with a report that we are already on track for a 4 degrees Celsius warmer world by the century's end. Wow. And that there's no certainty that adaptation to a 4 degrees Celsius world is even possible. I thought that was really an alarm.
Yeah, this is a topic that I've been following a lot for several years, and I'm actually really thinking that there's not much point to a labor movement in this scenario, especially one where, like, my union, as we read last week, the president of my union basically cussed out Barack Obama for canceling the Keystone XL pipeline. And they have to realize, you know, that things have changed. And I, quite frankly, have you ever heard of Guy McPherson?
Mm-mm, no.
Okay, GuyMcPherson.com has a blog called Nature Bats Last. Mm. And if you want to get real depressed, go read that. Quite frankly, according to him and many other experts, I have not read this book, but according to some experts that I've been paying attention to, Ms. Klein is a little bit too optimistic.
Is that right? Because if you read this book, she's not optimistic.
Well, the levels of optimism.
So one of the things that's interesting to me, because again, we know the problems, and I'm pretty sure the book is very clear in that for climate change to be effective, and I'm talking about like serious transformation of so diverting away from that gloom and doom that we're talking about, there has to be a reduction in or an abolishment of capitalism. It has to go. But here's the issue. The organizing strategy in terms of the environmental activism, not just in this country, but globally, where are we at in terms of organizing for the, because what I see a lot of, and again, I'm going back to these pseudo intellectuals, is that they like to call out individual people in neighborhoods about our recycling and our, you know, the types of things that we've been doing for over five decades.
No, and we've been trying to do. And not being.
Yeah, but I'm saying though, there's really been no push from the masses to like pressure these corporations to literally shut down their production in the sense that, or if they're doing it, of course the capitalist media is not emphasizing this. So
that's
a
really good point, Gus. And she addresses that in the book. And I think she does a really good job of really calling out environmental groups about just being too tepid and moderate about the situation. And let me just read a passage that really spoke to me that addresses what you're talking about.
And I think, and just before you read that too, let's be clear that we have to be very critical and honest that the people who are running these groups are the petty bourgeoisie liberals. I mean, I'm just being honest with you because they're
the intellectuals you were just talking about.
I mean, they're the ones driving this, but yeah, to the
well,
passage.
Well, okay. Yeah, because I probably fall under the petty bourgeoisie that you're talking about. But anyway, what she talks about is something called the fetish of centrism. And what she says is that dealing with climate change challenges something that might be even more powerful than capitalism. And that is the fetish of centrism, of reasonableness, seriousness, splitting the difference, and generally not getting overly excited about anything. This is the habit of thought that truly rules our era, far more among the liberals who concern themselves with matters of climate policy than among conservatives, many of whom simply deny the existence of the crisis. So she talks about how not wanting to appear like, you know, as an extremist on the left has really caused this problem to exacerbate.
Well, I think we have a real major problem with NGOs in general.
Yeah.
And that they are basically, well, it's like I tell people, if your organization moves its office, its headquarters to Washington, D.C., then it's time to start a new one. Because it's going to be inside the Beltway. It's bought off by grants.
Yep.
And, corporate grants, you know, it's a big deal with Planned Parenthood if Congress is going to cut some funding, and they should not be that dependent. Look what happened to Acorn.
Right.
And you know that Acorn still exists in other countries.
Yeah.
But it's not here. And that's what I worry about. And quite frankly, that's what's happened here with this radio station. It's got too dependent on grants.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. When we lost the CPB, we've been hurting.
I was just going to say that another point that she makes that kind of talks to what Gus mentioned is the extent to which green groups have really partnered with oil and gas companies instead of fighting them. And then one quote was that while green groups battle over research and voluntary codes, the oil and gas companies continue to drill, leak, and pay billions of dollars into new infrastructure designed to last for many decades. So
that's the petty bourgeoisie politics that we're talking about. They so you know you can't call yourself that because what the petty bourgeoisie does is they adopt these ideas because they want to ascend to the capitalist class level. That's what they're trying to push. So they'll do those things and they'll align thinking that I have a chance to actually be a part of something that was not made for me, you know, so that's why they disrupt class organization and left push and radical push against those corporations from destroying the climate. So yeah, I'm gonna go pick this book up the next couple of weeks because that's the kind of analysis that we need.
Yeah.
You know,
we also have the problem with these AstroTurf groups that are actually created by the energy companies. When adopt some type of environmentally friendly name or something like that. And, it's really hard to tell that they're actually being funded by the energy corporations.
Mm-hmm. You know,
they put out a lot of misleading information and a lot of misleading, statistics.
Mm-hmm. Kind of another thing that goes along with this that we were talking about before the show was how, trade agreements and climate agreements have been discussed and been put into place at the same time. However, trade agreements like NAFTA and currently they're working on the TPP, they've made those trade agreements enforceable. But the climate agreements are voluntary. And that's a big deal. It's when the climate agreements don't have any teeth, that's a real issue. And I think that might be going on in the COP21 talks right now.
Yeah. Yeah. We talked about the TPP on this show many times and the fact that, corporations could sue for potential losses actually, due to local, laws or whatever environmental laws that they would be forced to have to, try to accommodate. And so they can now sue in another country actually just because of a state law. Or a city law or something like that, county law, and they can sue over potential, losses of profits.
So. I mean, let's put this in perspective. Let's go into the mindset of the capitalists though. They don't consider this to be a human crisis You know, this is the, I mean, they're really not thinking from the perspective that we're thinking here, that the human lives that are destroyed by the, this nasty climate change right now. And also the potential, as you said, that's really big in the book, is that we're shifting close to a point to where we can't survive in this environment anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, this is like, we're reaching a very critical point. That's something that people were hinting at in the early 90s when the talk started.
We're but there now.
Yeah, we're there.
Right.
And
right.
I mean, really, we're almost at a point. And again, people know I'm not a nihilist, but we're very close to a point of no return if we don't do something very soon.
Right. And she really hammers that point home in this book quite a bit.
Yeah.
And kind of going along that whole capitalist solution to the problem, chapter 8 in this book was what I found the most scary, because a lot of the solutions that are being talked about are these really horrifying techno fixes.
Yeah.
One of the things that they talked about was sun dimming and spraying sulfate aerosols into the stratosphere to keep the the temperatures down. So when they talk about some of the solutions that are going on, that's pretty scary. So.
Bill's solution has always been to build wind farms and solar farms, put people to work that way.
Well, that would be a good idea. Plant trees. That'd be pretty good.
Yeah.
But I've been following this now, really fairly closely for several years. And what I have noticed in the more like left wing, possibly more friend stuff you get off radioforall.net, shows like that come from community radio stations and such, is that the trend has gone from, prevention to where now it's going to have to be mitigation. And this is the discussion of these experts. And of course they are all very, critical of geoengineering that you were describing, but there's a lot of talk now about things like biochar, which is some method of somehow sequestering carbon, in soil and is good for farming, and a lot of other things like that. But I really hate being this pessimistic, but I really think that the major problem is that there is, this is bizarre, I was thinking about it this morning, there's too much life on this planet.
Mm-hmm.
It creates the carbon, much like people talk about the livestock that we have.
Well, that really has more to do with consumption than the number of people.
It is the number of people. There's way too many people on this planet, and that is somewhere where the left has really fallen down for about the last 40 years. Because of because of memories of eugenics or something.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, I mean, that's just a fact.
Well, here's the thing. We consume way more in this country than...
Well, yeah, I understand that, too. And there's too many of us, is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
You know, it's a consumption issue, and it's also a population issue. And I remember back, maybe this is nostalgia, but I remember 3 billion people on the planet. And I really liked that. I don't know. I'm sorry.
Well, the thing of it is... Yeah, I have to admit that even if really, to be honest with you, after reading this book, I do wonder if it's too late. But, we in the West are the major consumers and that has to be addressed. And so far, I don't even know if in the COP21 talks that like you said, capitalism and consumerism is really even being addressed.
And that's the biggest thing that we have to realize. While Bill makes a point about, the population going up, that's not going to be as critical as the increased neoliberal global consumption that has been propagandized and pushed for so long since 1978 when the entire political economy shifted. You can have as many people, but neoliberalism doesn't go into full process. And David Harvey's book, A Brief History of Neoliberalism, is probably the most wonderful work that talks about this and how it has really shifted, particularly environmental climate problems, in that push. Because what it does is it spreads capitalism so far and increases production. And of course, we being the hub, the network of the global, political economy, that's what it's been doing. That has to be central to the organizing strategy, in that we can't mitigate and we prohibit. We have to take down. We have to use people power to organize and to abolish private ownership of the modes of production. That's the only way we're going to save our lives and save the earth. I mean, because it's going to be very difficult to stop population growth versus stopping private ownership of the modes of production from creating this horrible problem.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yeah.
Let's see if we can get our caller on the air here. WEFT, you're on the air.
Jim Hyman. Thanks for playing Bourgeois Blues. I knew it was either between 37 and 38, but it was 37.
37, yeah. Thanks, Jim. Yeah.
And it was really the Communist Party through the International Legal Fund that they have that actually got Lefdelli out of prison. They did a lot of good things in the 1930s.
The Communist Party got Lefdelli out of prison?
That's correct.
All right.
Through their International Labor Defense Fund.
All right. You got some comments on the Naomi Klein?
Got some comments
Klein?
On the end of the world that we're talking about.
The Naomi Klein.
We are talking about the end of the world. The end of human beings on this planet, perhaps all alive.
Okay, I can comment on this.
All right.
There is a difference between climate deniers and climate skeptics. Skeptics know that there is some relevance to human cost here. The deniers are just absolute lost. But the problem is that in the entire conference, it was never mentioned that wars are inextricably intertwined with global warming. That is a major problem here.
Yeah, sure.
The military is like a gigantic polluter.
Right.
You know, American military is like the biggest polluter on this planet, isn't it?
It's right up there, Bill. Yes, absolutely.
Sorry, Jim, I just got plugged in where I could hear you.
Okay. yeah, you're absolutely right. So the problem is both war and, they're just intertwined with each other.
And if I remember right from reading about the COP21, talks going on, I think the military is exempt from any climate issues.
Interesting.
So now they say maybe we can get 2% Celsius. That's even 2% Celsius is way too much.
Oh, right. By the way,
right.
Hey, Jim, let me explain to people too, just in case, because I used to have a problem with this. Celsius is 1.8 degrees Fahrenheit.
Right.
So 2 degrees Celsius is 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit.
There you go.
Yeah. That is unacceptable.
Yeah. All right. Hey, thanks for the call, Jim.
Sure. Anytime.
All right. Bye-bye. So yeah, he brings up how wars and that are intertwined, of course, with the capitalism like that. We know that militaristic attitude.
Yeah, we're talking about the Eisenhower Doctrine going all the way back to that.
The Carter Doctrine, setting up the military industrial complex.
Setting up for the imperial. You know, works, and we can even go back before that. We can go back to the colonization of Africa. To really start talking about exploitation, especially during that time period is when the industrial working class expanded. The Belgians, yeah. I mean, so like I said, I think that's a very critical point for our listeners that just heard what Jim said and what we just talked about. If the military is not included in these talks at the climate summit, I mean, really, we're basically being extremely super. I mean, they are being extremely superficial because, like Bill said, the military is one of the largest polluters on this planet, and they're not even being included. So even it's a rigged game from the setup, and that's why we can't. And I think that's what the book is really trying to say is that we have to adjust our strategy and how to deal with this. We can no longer try to go in and reform this climate change thing. We have to organize ourselves, and we have to talk about possibly general strikes. We have to talk about shutting down production in places and pressure these corporations to reduce what they're doing in neoliberal imperialist capitalist agendas.
I was just going to say too, these also have to be at restructuring not only just capitalism but many things in our society, and making our society much more decentralized so that I'm not driving 30 miles a day to a job in a car spewing out fumes.
Right.
Right.
That we're getting our food locally.
Right. And I can get glass bottles that will be 100% recycled instead of this plastic crap that's poisoning the entire planet along with carbon. Well, it's actually a complex hydrocarbon itself.
Yeah.
Anything you can make with hydrocarbons, you can make with carbohydrates. Yeah. It's just one step further.
Right. I just wanted to say that Naomi Klein had a speech yesterday at the COP21 talks, and she talked about what was called a LEAP manifesto, and this was specifically for Canada, but some of the solutions that this LEAP manifesto suggests, I think, could really be applied everywhere. Creative, innovative ownership structures, democratically run, paying living wages and keeping much needed revenue in communities, which is what you guys were just talking about. A universal program to build energy efficient homes and retrofit existing housing, training and other resources for workers who are in carbon intensive jobs so that they can get jobs in the green, economy. Invest in our decaying public infrastructure, move to a far more localized and ecologically based ag system. So anyway, those are just some of the things. And end to fossil fuel subsidies. As we all know, oil and gas companies are heavily subsidized. Financial transition transaction taxes, increased resource royalties, et cetera, et cetera.
So. And by the way, folks, if we don't take great action, and I believe that we're about 20 years away from Soylent Green, if we can survive that long without major action. And Soylent Green is the capitalist version of the future. For all of you who don't remember, it's a 1973 movie where Edward G. Robinson gives a monologue about how great the world was before the greenhouse effect.
Yeah.
I mean, this movie, the reason this movie is based on a society being greatly affected by global warming.
Yes. Is really interesting.
One of the most popular movies of the early 1970s.
Very powerful movie. All right.
Starring the great Charlton Heston, right-wing
Mr. NRA himself.
he's got problems with now, but he would probably be definitely against the idea of global warming, you know.
And once again, we want to thank our guest, Nancy Dietrich, for coming in. What's the title of Naomi Klein's book again?
This Changes Everything, Capitalism Versus the Climate.
That's it. Exactly. Any closing comments from any of our hosts or guests?
Go pick that book up and hold study groups with this book and invite community members and talk about these things. That's the only way this type of political education spreads is if we read these things, we study them, and then we hold study groups like the Great Aware Group, Radical Reading Group, and all these other great reading groups where we study and we talk about these ideas, and people are influenced and develop a consciousness about what steps to take forward and how to develop a collectivity to fight these things. So please study this, read it, and hold study groups with community members.
And also try to find ways to take action, because we're at a point where, she even mentions in her book, it's going to take from the bottom up movements.
Exactly.
And one way you can take action is go to weft.org, then find the donation page.
Support.
Copy that URL, go to your Facebook, and send it to all your friends.
Yep.
Post it.
Yep.
Every week.
You can go to the climate rally, just started a minute or two ago over there at the Alma Mater. And this is put on by the Students for Environmental Concerns and the Champaign-Urbana for Bernie Sanders group. And, I'm sure they're going to be an active group out there at the Alma Mater right now. And remember that the, Lockout Rockout is happening this evening at 10:05 North Dunlap in Savoy, supporting the, locked out Clifford Jacobs workers. And, any other closing words there, guys? No? Well, as Dave would say, be safe and power to the people. We're going to leave you with an updated version of the Bourgeois Blues. This is from Eric Bibb and a guy, French harmonica player, J.J. Miltau. And, then we'll take you to Labor History in 2, and then stay tuned for Charles Showalter's The Union Edge after that. So, be safe and power to the people.